Brian Hyatt from Rolling Stone, and you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I have with me today Andy Green from Rolling Stone and Brittany Spanos from Rolling Stone. Hey, guys.
Hey.
So we're going to start by playing Andy Green's interview with The Edge. You two are going on a Joshua Tree tour for the second time, much like Bruce Springsteen went on a River tour for the second time last year. And that, basically, they're going to play the whole album, right, Andy?
Yes.
Among other things, apparently.
Yeah, it'll be like 1 hour of the Joshua Tree and 1 hour of non-Joshua Tree.
Right. And it sold like a billion tickets. They're adding dates. It's gone crazy, which is funny because they play a lot of the Joshua Tree most nights anyway.
Yeah, what's funny is basically every tour they've done since the Joshua Tree has been the four big hits off the Joshua Tree. So this is telling the fans, hey, do you know those songs on Joshua Tree that you only kind of know? Well, we're playing those too.
It's you know, it shows the power of a sort of a branding thing, and also just the excitement, I guess, of a full nostalgia trip. But anyway, so when you talked to The Edge, you didn't know much about the tour before the announcement, right?
I talked to him in late December, like 2 weeks before the announcement. So all I knew at that moment was there was going to be a Joshua Tree tour. So I was going in kind of blind.
Gotcha. So that explains your total cluelessness in the interview that follows. And the first thing is Andy asked The Edge, like, what even is this tour? So let's start the interview, and afterwards we'll talk a little bit about this tour and U2's current state.
So I was told the basics of this tour, that it's the Joshua Tree. So just sort of give me the background and tell me how it came together.
Well, you know, when we came off the last tour, the Innocence and Experience Indoor Tour, we headed straight into finishing the second album of that set. Mm-hmm. If you want, the first album, Songs of Innocence, and the second, Songs of Experience, which we were pretty much complete with. You know, a couple of weeks of the final touches leading up to the end of the year and the election, and then suddenly the world changed, and we just went, hold on a second. We've got to give ourselves a moment to think about this record,
right,
and to think about how it relates to what's going on in the world, because it was written mostly, I mean, some of it was started before 2006, but most of it was written in the early part of 2006. And now, as I think you'd agree, the world's a different place.
I mean, are you talking about Trump and Brexit?
The Trump election, and mm-hmm. It's like a pendulum has suddenly just taken a huge swing in the other direction. Right. So anyway, we then were looking at the anniversary of the Joshua Tree, and another thing started to dawn on us, which is that, weirdly enough, things have kind of come full circle, if you want. You know, that record was written in the mid-80s. This was during the Reagan-Thatcher era of British and U.S. politics. It was a period when there was a lot of unrest. Thatcher was in the throes of trying to put down the miners' strike. There was all kinds of shenanigans going on in Central America, and it feels like we're right back there,
right,
in a way that I don't think any of our work has ever come full circle to that extent. So it just felt like, wow, these songs have a new meaning and new resonance today that they didn't have 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And so it was kind of serendipitous, really. It was just a realization that we needed to put the album sort of on ice for a minute, just to really think about it. Think about it one more time before putting it out, just to make sure that it really was what we wanted to say. Mm-hmm. And then this commemoration. So we just look, let's do both. We can really celebrate this album, which is somewhat, you know, born again in this context, and we can also really get a chance to think about these songs and make sure that they're exactly what we want to put out. So the two sort of coincided, and we decided we were going to do some shows. And we've never given ourselves the opportunity to celebrate our past, because we'd always, as a band, looked forward. Mm-hmm. But I think we felt that this was a special moment, and this is a very special record.
Right.
And so we're happy to take this moment to regroup and think about an album that's so many years old, but still seems relevant.
Yeah, so the shows are going to feature the album straight through. Are you going to play it in sequence?
I believe we will. And I say I believe we will because that is certainly the working assumption right now. Not necessarily starting. I mean, the show may not start with track one, side one, Where the Streets Have No Name, because we feel like maybe we need to, I don't know, build up to that moment. Yeah. So we're still in the middle of kind of figuring out exactly how the running order will go. But yes, we will be playing the album in sequence.
And the fans are going to be thrilled because there's songs in there you haven't played live in a while, and with Red Hill Mining Town, that's a song that you guys have never played.
That's true. That's true. And what actually, I had a couple of days at the end of a studio session where I was listening to that song and working on guitar parts from that song, which I hadn't thought about for so many years. And that in itself, as a tune, is just right slap bang in some ways with what's going on. I mean, I don't know if you're staying in touch with what's going on in the UK, but it's suddenly, I mean, it's not quite as intense, but industrial action breaking out all over the UK for the first time in generations. It's like, it's not exactly the repeat of the Winter of Discontent, but it's like, it is wild that those issues are coming back. It does seem like politics is polarizing,
right,
in so many parts of the developed world.
Yeah, and
to an extent that I find worrying. I'm sure most people do. And you know, those days were difficult, dark times. And personally, you know, we really would hate to see us go back there.
Right. And so, why do you think that's the one song on the album that you never played live? Is it difficult to sing or play at all, or if you just never got to it?
I think it was probably one of the songs that, due to tempo and arrangement, never found a place within the live set. And it's funny, sometimes great songs just, you know, they're not in a, almost like, think of a live set as like an ecosystem. You've got niches to fill.
Right.
And, you know, the ones that are the up-tempo, fast, dramatic songs, you know, those are the ones that are crucial. And then the sort of more medium-tempo songs, no matter how great they are, sometimes you just can't find a place for them. So I don't think it was anything more complicated than that. But
right.
Listening back to it, I'm like, wow, you may not know this, but when we had first finished the album, very like within a few days of finishing, within the band, Red Hill Mining Town was our leading contender for first single.
Wow.
And we were, we went ahead and we made a video for it with Neil Jordan, and we were like pretty confident. And then, you know, as the weeks went by and we sort of got back our objectivity, views started to change, and eventually it became With or Without You, indeed, I think we were correct. But such was the level of enthusiasm about that song.
And then there's
immediately after finishing the record that it was our first single. That was people's mentality. That was the one.
Yeah. Then there's Exit and Trip Through Your Wires, which you haven't played since the '80s, and you've done in God's Country. You've done acoustic a couple times, but never full band. So those three songs will also be great to hear again.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, they're all so diverse, and that's what's interesting about the Joshua Tree is it was a very broad, you know, CinemaScope kind of record. At the time, we were thinking about it in cinematic terms. I mean, so much of the photography that goes with the album, the sort of the scope was cinematic, and we for sure we were thinking about the songs from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. And also the sort of the literary inspirations and references. In fact, Exit's original working title was Executioner's Song, because we were using a lot of literature as a kind of jumping off point for the songs, in terms of just taking our work in a slightly different direction.
Right.
You know, we definitely we were falling into the arms of America, in the sense, as a band, we, you know, punk rock was so much about establishing a unique form of music, not influenced by American music. Now if you listen to our early records, you know, you can hear the influence of a lot of German contemporary music at the time, and via UK bands that were listening to the same music. But the Joshua Tree is the first album we really sort of consciously went, okay, we spent like four albums now thinking about Europe, Ireland, but let's take a look at the roots of this form that we are inevitably part of, and those are all American.
Right. So
we looked at American. We looked at the blues. We looked at a lot of. We looked at the new journalism. Myself and Bono were reading Flannery O'Connor, so the Southern writers, and you know, it was a conscious effort to look across the Atlantic and to start to explore America. And I mean, it's for someone from Ireland, it's a vast source of ideas and aspirations and inspirations
for
generations. You know, America's been the promised land, and you know, we're looking at it in that regard, but also, you know, what America really was. I mean, I read Soledad Brothers, you know, I was reading, about the Black Panthers. We were exploring America from all kinds of angles.
Right. So.
And at the time, this was a Reagan moment where, in some ways, that vision of what America could be seemed to be somewhat under threat.
Right.
The America of Thomas Jefferson, the America of John F. Kennedy, these visionaries who were talking about, you know, the ideals of what America could be.
Right.
So we were grappling with those big ideas, and now here we are again.
it's
crazy.
Hey, this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt, and you were just listening to Andy Green interviewing The Edge of U2. We're going to be back in a minute with more from The Edge. Stick with us.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
We're going to play you more from Andy Green's interview with Edge from U2. And in this part, Andy's going to ask a little bit about what the other songs are on the Joshua Tree tour that are not Joshua Tree, and then kind of probe into the band's future, and then also make some special pleading for some songs that we've long wanted you to play on tour. So here's more from Andy's interview with The Edge.
So the non-Joshua Tree parts of the show, do you know what kind of songs that are going to be featured there?
I think, obviously, whenever we go to do anything live, we are looking to establish a through line, mm-hmm. thematic core that we can hold to. And we're kind of spoiled and lucky that in the canon there's a lot to draw from.
Mm-hmm.
Being kind of early on in the process, it's hard for me to say exactly what we will be looking mm-hmm. to, but I think it's fair to say that all the old songs are going to be considered, and what we finally end up playing will cohere to whatever that core theme is. Mm-hmm. And we're doing shows in America, we're doing shows in Europe, but certainly the American shows, I've no doubt that a lot of it will be, focused on that mythic America that we were writing about during the Joshua Tree, and
Do you think it's
where
possible?
Where it is, what it is.
Do you think it's possible that you'll do any B sides like Wave of Sorrow or do Luminous Times or something? Or
we've done a few B sides in our shows prior to now. It's so hard in some ways for a song to make the set because it's not about, the quality of the song. It's really about what you have to leave out to make space for it. And
right.
We're ambitious to the extent that we always want to cater to what you might call the Uber fans who have seen multiple shows and they want to see something novel they've never seen before, something obscure and unique, and we know that, and we try as much as we can to make that possible, but we are also aware of the fact that the great majority of people at the shows have possibly only ever seen us that once or a couple of times before, and there's a very long list of classic songs that they want to hear and see, and
right.
So it's that balance, we for sure, for our own amusement as well. It's often really a lot of fun to take something from the past that we haven't played so often and reinterpret it. So no doubt we'll be looking into that.
I don't think
we're going to find like a huge emphasis on obscure and
right, a stadium.
Little heard U2 songs. I think there'll be a few that we will... For sure. We mentioned Exit, Trip to the Wires,
yeah.
God's Country, and Red Hill Mining Town. That's four songs that, Red Hill never been played live.
Right.
And the other three are extremely seldom heard. So,
yeah.
So there you go. But maybe, who knows? I wouldn't rule out B-sides.
Yeah, I think the two songs the fans are most dying to hear are Acrobat and Drowning Man. Do you think either of those are at all possible to be finally played?
That's very interesting. I didn't know that fans were interested in Drowning Man. I mean, Acrobat, for sure, I guess, because it was one of those kind of more dramatic pieces from Action Baby, but that's interesting, and I'll take note of that.
Yeah.
We always want to listen to our fans because, in my experience, music fans are seldom wrong.
Right.
There's something to what they say, so I will take note of that.
Yeah,
I'm not saying we will definitely do it, but
sure.
We're at that wonderful situation where we've got a blank canvas.
Yeah, and I think they miss when you do a song. They miss Numb or Van Diemen's Land because it used to always be a cool Edge moment when you would do a song.
Yeah, well, You know, I do sing a lot, as you know.
Yeah, sure.
Pretty much always backing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Bono's actually the one who's often pushing me to take a vocal. And you know what? I'm fine singing a lead, but I'm also aware of the fact that we have a really good singer in the band. It's sort of like, I guess it's the opportunity just hasn't seemed right for the last few tours, but yeah, I wouldn't rule that out either.
And you're playing Bonnaroo. I'm sure that's going to be fun. That's a very different kind of thing for you guys.
Yeah, we haven't played festivals for a number of years, but we did a lot of festivals early on, and I always remember them very fondly for various reasons. There's a kind of gladiatorial aspect to a festival, which was always kept you on your toes in a good way, but also the opportunity to just rub shoulders with your peers and be in a backstage situation with other artists and other bands.
Yeah.
It's one of the disadvantages of doing your own shows is you tend to just not have those opportunities as often, you know, and I think, you know, we've formed a lot of friendships early on playing shows with Simple Minds and Eurythmics and various bands, and that's an important part of it for me. So I'm looking forward to that.
And so what kind of like what sort of stage are you going to be using at these stadiums? Will it be like the original tour in 87, or how are you going to stage it?
I don't think we want to be too slavish,
right?
But at the same time, we want to be to acknowledge the aesthetic ideas that went with the record. So, I don't think we're going to go overboard in terms of reinventing the wheel, but we will definitely take those aesthetic ideas and kind of update them somewhat.
Right.
This is kind of Joshua Tree 2017. It's not Joshua Tree 1986.
Right. No, but I'm sure the word nostalgia is going to get tossed around this tour. So how do you feel about that?
Well, as I say, yeah. I mean, I think what's important for us is that it's not really about nostalgia. There's an element of nostalgia which we can't avoid, but it's not motivated by a desire to look backwards. It's almost like this album's come full circle.
Right. So
and we're back there again. And it's kind of got a relevance.
Right. Yeah,
that,
I agree. So do you think the next record is going to be songs of experience, or is it possible that it will be something else entirely?
No, I think it's songs of experience. I mean,
okay.
When I say it's almost done, you know, we definitely want to take this opportunity to think about it, make sure it's really what we want to put out, given the changes that have occurred in the world. And maybe little will change, but we absolutely want to take that chance to just reconsider everything. And who knows?
Right.
We may even write a couple of new songs, you know, because that's the great position we're in. We've given ourselves a little bit of a breathing space for creativity.
Yeah, so
do you
think at the end of the Joshua Tree tour, the Innocence and Experience tour, will get revved back up again with that same staging, and it'll just be in a new leg of it?
We feel like that tour wasn't finished.
Right.
So right now, we'd love to finish that tour, which is, I would imagine it's going to be with very similar production components.
Huh.
But, you know, it's. I would hate to attempt to see too far into the future, and, you know, that's the working assumption. But things can change, and nothing's written in stone as yet. But we felt like that tour and that project was not completed. It is still alive in our minds creatively.
Right. All right. My final question here before I let you go. Do you have any ideas about how the next album is going to be released? Because there's so much attention paid to the distribution of the last record. So do you have any thoughts about how the next one, how it might come out?
Yeah, well, my plan is that Bono and I would sneak into everyone's house and put a CD under their pillow.
Okay.
But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be getting much support from the rest of the band. But no, I think, again, you know, it's quite interesting the way music distribution and promotion and marketing has sort of been thrown into turmoil over the last number of years. And, you know, what seems like the most cutting edge and most innovative idea within like 6 months is like old hat and, you know,
right,
been done. It's no longer novel or groundbreaking. So, and it's also, I'm so aware of the fact that sales of vinyl records are going
right
through the roof.
I mean,
it's just, it's sort of really crazy to see that. And it speaks about so many things to do with, you know, the artifact, the object of a vinyl record and what that signifies to people versus a digital download, a file, you know. People in the end have an emotional connection with a great record and with the artist. And, you know, a digital file, I mean, look, convenience is wonderful. If I'm being honest, I still have my vinyl collection, but I use digital files 90% of the time. But I would never give up my vinyl. And so there's some sort of need for both. And I find that somewhat reassuring that in the midst of convenience being king, there's still this connection with the artifact and the sort of the deep emotional connection that people have with the body of work that is an album. So who knows? You know, we're still trying to figure it out like everyone else is. What I find heartwarming is that music seems to be, music culture and music is still at the forefront, and, you know, people are enjoying it and reveling in it and turning to it for all kinds of reasons. I'm interested to see if in this new post-truth world, whether music sort of reconnects with the sort of activist protest sort of thread that it had for so many years and seems to have lost recently. You know, I think it's that aspect of music is, and always has been, to my mind, a kind of important, crucial part of what drew me to it and why I think a lot of people are drawn to it. So I feel that this is a moment where music might go through a kind of renaissance of a kind, and I'm very excited to see what, you know, young kids in their garages across North America and Europe are going to be writing about and releasing over the next number of years.
Yeah,
I think it's time to get back to some of that.
Right. I guess final question. Do you think there'll be a Octoon Baby tour in 2021?
No plans.
Uh-huh.
But never say never.
All right.
We just played a bunch of Andy's interview with The Edge from U2. Talking about the Joshua Tree tour, not the one from the 80s, but the new one that's happening in May and is hitting stadiums and is like selling out everywhere. It's like beyond selling out. It's like it sells out. They add new dates. Those sell out. So it's interesting. I mean, you two are in a unique place in their career. I have a distorted picture because I did like our last three cover stories on them for Rolling Stone, so I've spent a lot of time with them. So I my point of view isn't like the world's point of view, and I also all three of us I think like you two,
yes.
and that is not you know, or love you two, and that is not necessarily the case with some music writers and some music fans. There's like a real a real hostility towards them in some circles. And Brittany, do you know what? How do young people see you two right now?
I mean, I think when I kind of learned about you two, I would think I was like around 12, and you know, Vertigo came out and stuff like that. So I think that people sort of have this idea, like when U2 was like really cool in the early 2000s, I feel like that was a good moment for them, for my generation.
Sure.
And I feel like the whole Apple thing was like a big turn off, and I think it was like sort of this, that I feel like that was the most negative vibe about U2 that I've seen in my lifetime. But I don't know, I think there's kind of a weird idea of the hierarchy of rock and classic rock, and the idea of the old gatekeepers, but I feel like U2 kind of goes back and forth on that, like on that sort of ideology.
I feel like because they're in a situation, because they never stopped, because they never like settled into being like just that band that made the Joshua Tree and Octung Baby and then disappeared, because they continue, they don't get a chance to bask in the sort of iconic status that they should have from that in quite the way they would if they hadn't just kept going.
Exactly.
And so they fall between, whereas like young people might worship Fleetwood Mac and like or think the Stones are cool or whatever, like there's something about the U2, like they're, I think it's honestly the same thing, I you know, it's one of my pet topics, but it's the same thing like with Madonna, where it's like, how dare she like continue on, like just be the thing in the past. And it's like I don't find that fair or an interesting or like an interesting way of looking at things, but I do think that's part of it. But this, that said, so they, you know, so they released Songs of Innocence and put it on everyone's iPhone, and it was very controversial. And you know, from what they told me, the part they didn't really understand, they wanted to make it available for everyone. They didn't quite get, they say, that it would actually download onto people's phones, which was like perhaps a step too far. It's like I think Bono said, it's like they meant to leave the milk on the doorstop, but instead the milk like appeared in the refrigerator. So that said, I think everyone was like a little hysterical about that. I think the reactions were like a little over the top.
Oh, definitely.
But yeah. And I think a lot of it seems a little silly now. But, and then what happened is that tour turned out to be quite excellent. And I think a lot of people who wrote really mean things about the album, because there was even like, you know, the controversy over the delivery method of the album actually carried into the actual reception of the music. And people were like, rather than being like, I don't know if I like this album, instead they were like, this is like dystopian garbage, like it's evil. And it's like, whoa. I mean, you know, and so then the very same songs delivered live and, you know, months distance from the whole thing, people were like, oh, I'm kind of liking this. So you two have already kind of already regained equilibrium. That said, there's tremendous pressure on the next album, right, Andy?
Yes, that is Songs of Experience, and they've been talking about this record for about 3 years now, which is a long time, and they kind of pledged a few years ago that they'd never take years and years on an album again, and it happened again.
Well, the amazing joke is that, so in 2009, right. When I did my first U2 cover story, Bono told me about the plans for another album called Songs of Ascent.
Right.
And that one is now supposed to follow Songs of Experience,
They keep planning a Zeropa-like album to the Octune Baby of the previous album.
Yeah.
But Zeropa, it just kind of works when Octune Baby is a huge, huge hit, and then you could sort of put out like the Amnesiac or something.
Yeah, right. Well, now you're
just. Sorry, I'm mixing my metaphors.
I understand. Like, well, in other words, like the leftover songs that are like about as good, kind of thing. Yeah, yes.
Right, there's not a huge craving for the leftovers of an album that wasn't met with real rapture to begin with.
So, I mean, the other factor with U2 is just in general this idea of fighting gravity. I think that's how Bono has put it. Like, it's always like, how do you keep a band with all its original members that never broke up, that never paused, how do you keep them kind of like at the level they need to be U2? Because U2 cannot diminish, really. A small U2 doesn't really work. Like, you can't have like a U2 playing theaters. It's fundamental. They were a band that were meant to be in arenas from the moment they played clubs. So it's like this thing of like, how do you keep this sort of balloon aloft? And they've managed to do it. And now this is like a different trick, right? I mean, this is unexpected.
I mean, if you think of the Stones 40 years in, they'd been just redoing their past for decades and decades. They lasted about 15 years tops as far as moving forward with new hit songs and everything. So U2 in a lot of ways has outlived like any rock band's life twice over almost.
So have they earned the right to do this tour that looks back at this point, Brittany?
I think they definitely do, especially with the influence that the Joshua Tree has had on rock music from the moment that it was released. And I mean, U2 in general, like you, like Andy said, like they have always been, they've outlived sort of the, like what the Stones have done or what these other big rock bands have done. And they've always been an arena band. So I think that kind of looking back, they've earned that time. But I feel like this will probably be a very rare occasion for them to look back, especially with the other albums they have planned.
I think you're right. And I mean, it would be remiss not to point out that so Springsteen last year, as we mentioned, did the River Tour. It started out like, hey, maybe I'll do one show for the River. And then it's like, hey, what about maybe a bunch of shows? And how about I go all year? And then it turned out to be the highest grossing tour of last year. It beat Beyonce.
Yeah.
So there is now a precedent for that.
Well, yeah, and there's no shame in it. And people, largely speaking, they don't go to concerts to hear new songs. People like to hear stuff they know.
At some, well, you know, if you see Justin Bieber, but yes, right.
But
those
are songs they know and love. If they've known them for 6 months, that's a long time when you're 14, you know.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Yes. But for heritage, quote unquote, heritage acts, they want to see the classic stuff, which is very frustrating if you're an artist who wants to keep moving forward.
Right. But if you're Fleetwood Mac and you understand that, embrace it, it's very comfortable.
Yes.
Very easy.
One thing that's always struck me about Joshua Tree is it's a very front-loaded album as far as hits. And I now appreciate the second half or second side a lot. But I will say that when I was a kid, I had it on cassette. I basically never listened to the second side, like, ever. I listened to it once. I was like, I don't know. And so I just kept listening to the first side. So to this day, I think there's still, like, sort of a backlog in my second side appreciation.
It's front-loaded with hits, as you said. But I think Exit, I think Muzzah Disappeared, and God's Country are as strong as the songs on side one. They just aren't as radio-friendly, and they weren't pushed to, you know, as singles.
They're almost like the cool B-sides as much as they are the other half of the album, which is weird.
Yeah, but there are cool B-sides also.
And there's even cooler B-sides. Yeah, we're talking, there's Luminous Times, which has a really, which kind of like totally predicted the sound of the second Arcade Fire album.
Right.
It's a crazy thing if you listen to it.
Yeah, there's the Birdland, there's the Patti Smith song. I mean, that they.
But, yeah, I mean, in general, where is the political message of Joshua Tree, guys? Where do you see it?
I see it, as Edge told me, as an anti-Reagan, anti-Thatcher album. With the Riddle Mining Town, was about all the labor that was, all the strikes that were going on across England against Thatcher. With Bolt the Blue Sky, it was against Reagan's foreign policy in Central America.
And you were saying in some random performance not long ago, there's always like a rap kind of in Bolt of the Blue Sky and Bono really unleashed against
they
Trump.
They played a show, Dreamforce, and they played like an hour-long set a few months ago. And during Bolt the Blue Sky, Bono just went off against Trump in a way he hasn't against the sitting president in a long time. Because even during the Bush years, he worked with Bush on debt relief. So he was very careful not to be critical. But with Trump, it's a new ballgame now. So I think the bullet rap, as the fans call it, during the show when they play Bolt the Blue Sky, be very intense.
Yeah. I mean, it also strikes me that just this sort of like spiritual dislocation of this album, which really hits you at the very beginning. Streets Have No Name. I mean, literally dislocated. The streets have no name.
Yeah.
I haven't found what I'm looking for. I'm lost. That, like that.
Yeah.
I think.
You're ready to stand still.
I think it's going to be incredibly. I'm realizing this now as I say it. I actually think it's going to be incredibly moving and powerful in the context of like people. It's going to be an interesting. Because. One of the, you two are best when you like really need them. It's kind of like Springsteen, like, and in those, Brittany, you're talking about the All That You Can't Leave Behind era. When I saw them in New York after 9/11, and this is like a very famous set of gigs, but I mean, like, it was so intense and so emotional. They are capable of this tremendous uplift, I would say, like, almost no other artist who ever, you know, played rock music. And so maybe this will be an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I never really thought about the political message of the album until I read Andy's interview and kind of went back to it. And it just felt so appropriate for the moment, even, you know, so many decades separated from it. And just felt like, just like really potent and disillusioned and angry, and felt really, like you said, like really right for the moment, and felt really connected to this and very malleable to what's going on right now.
All right. Then it ends with the Mothers of the Disappeared, this incredibly sad, mournful song against all the victims of Pinochet's, you know, like purges of young people all throughout Chile.
Right.
You know, it's about as sad as the last songs you'd ever get on an album.
And yeah, to suggest the power and doom that can be caused by American neglect. So it's all relevant. And the other thing is the nostalgia element, because as hard as things might have seemed in 1986, like, people are really scared right now. So I think just being kind of re-entering the womb of 80s U2 will be right. Very comforting
and
for people.
I think the same way that Roger Waters took the Wall tour and really used the same exact songs with the video imagery that he put up on the wall, made it about the present.
Right.
I'm sure U2, that the imagery they'll have up and everything will really tie it all home too. I'm sure they're going to spend a long time on each song getting...
That's actually a great comparison point, which is the Wall tour show that you can radically recontextualize the album. And it would be interesting for them. I wonder how aware they were of the Wall tour. They're not huge Floyd fans. But that's a good example of how you can, like, I mean, he recontextualized it to the point where it was like, Roger, does any of this have anything to do with the album?
When he took Mother, which was about his own mother, essentially, and made it about big government.
Yeah, but he pulled it off, which is just...
He did.
It was a radical kind of thing to do, and I think it that does open a door for you too. That's interesting too. But so, are we going to see more and more of these tours from what's left of big bands of album focused tours?
So many of them already, and most big groups have done this now. Like, there's, I think, a few exceptions. You know, Stones haven't really done one yet, though. They toured for Sticky Fingers, but they only played it live at the One Club show,
right?
It's a guaranteed way to move tickets. And in an era when bands are touring more and more and more, they need a hook for fans to come. And this is seen as the ultimate hook. It's working. That's why Brian Wilson is doing Pet Sounds for like the fifth time right now. It sells tickets.
When you spoke to Adam Clayton, and by the way, Andy's full article on U2's new tour is in the next issue of Rolling Stone that comes out next week. And that also includes an interview with Adam Clayton and with Willie Williams, their longtime stage designers. But Adam kind of backed off from playing the whole album, right? I mean, no, sorry, from playing the album in order.
Sequence, yeah. He was unsure. The press release says in sequence, I'm pretty sure. The Edge said in sequence. Adam was like, I don't know about in sequence. We might sprinkle in a few other songs that tie into it. I'm just not sure yet.
Yeah.
So no matter what, they're playing all of it, probably in sequence, but they haven't rehearsed it yet. They still have like 4 months.
The sort of back and forth that I was having with you two for years now when I talk to them is just this idea of some other people at their point in their career, like, they make albums, but they give up on the idea of, like, listen, we're not going to be played on the radio. We're guys in our 50s. It's just not going to happen. And I was like, you know, is it possible it's time to, like, not worry about that and just make whatever you want to make? And they just basically have been like, no. They insist on... So, what do you think of that? Is it admirable or is it crazy to still want to be, like, at least preserve the possibility of, like, we want an actual hit on top 40 at this point in their career?
I think it's really admirable, and I think that especially with how long of a streak U2 has as, you know, a rock band on radio is incredible. I think that no other band can really match that. They were making hits on rock radio, on pop radio for decades, and that's difficult, and I think it's extremely, that's what makes it even more admirable, is that they want to keep going with that and keep sort of dominating that space, which a lot of bands can't really say they can do at this moment.
Andy, I think you disagree ultimately.
I do to some degree. I think it's admirable if it doesn't impact the album. I think a song like Get On Your Boots off No Lie on the Horizon was their attempt at a radio hit.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the worst songs on the album. And
I kind of like it, but it's nutty and it's jammed together.
And even Vertigo was like Elevation. They tried to do it again. And I think they'd be better suited just trying to make a great album and realizing that no matter what they do, radio is not going to put one of their songs onto the pop charts. It's not going to happen. There's no rock band now that can really do that.
Well, somewhere there's like a bunch of songs they recorded with Red One, who was Wes Gaga's producer, and so I'd love to hear like what that. And then, you know, they're always trying to work with like When Will I Am is the hot producer. I mean, it's bold, and occasionally it would pay off. I mean, wasn't there a rumor about them and the Chainsmokers? Or did I make that up?
Oh, I think that was. They talked about like Bono was going to enter some type of recording session with them.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, so it seems like something that might have happened. So
I just think that, you know, you have to accept at a certain point that your day on the radio is over. You can have a new era of your career where you make great albums, great music, and your fans love it. But there's not going to be a new With or Without You. It's just sort of impossible.
I would say that I realized that probably the bigger thing in the radio, and this is from like what Brian Eno told me, is this thing, they will leave off great songs from their albums, not because of the radio, but because they need songs that, as I said, for the ecosystem of their live show.
Well, that's, so that's very tough. Different. That's,
but yeah, that is very different, but that is the problem. So anyway, so we've been talking about Joshua Tree. We played Andy's interview with The Edge, and this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. Please come back and listen to us at 1 p.m. on Volume next week. And check out our downloadable podcast at rollingstone.com/podcast or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great week.